Andrea Hagen, it's a great pleasure to have you here at Booktopia.
Great to be here.
I have to ask you, first of all, what are you reading right now?
Well, I've been reading quite a lot of material from the 19th century. Big novels are interesting me at the moment. Trollope, Dickens again. That George Gissing world of, you know, busy streets and emerging media, people beginning to relate to each other in a different way because of the technology relating to communication. That's all interesting me at the moment because I'm writing a big fat novel.
How do you know that it's going to be big and fat?
It feels fat. It's like, I don't know what it's like to have a baby for a woman, but I imagine you might know at some level just what kind of child is in you. And I feel that this is just a big fat London novel. And so, although it's set now and it's a contemporary novel, it takes quite a lot of its cues from the classic Victorian novel. So I find myself immersed in them and getting quite cosy with Trollope at the moment.
It's interesting that the novel is set in London because I watched a video that you did recently which was about attempting to cross the road at one of London's busiest junctions. And in fact, you start your video kind of essay with references to Samuel Pepys and his experience of traffic in London at his time. It made me wonder whether there is anything that you can't write about, because I mean, crossing a road in and of itself is not that interesting, and yet you make it fascinating.
Well, it was the London Review's editor, the great Mary Kay Wilmers, who called me, and sometimes I think she's just putting me to the test. You know, she's the woman who sent me into New Orleans 3 days after Hurricane Katrina had hit. She's the person who encouraged me to write about my association with Julian Assange. This woman has no fear, at least for me. Mm. But then she called me up and said, there's a particularly annoying road at the meeting point of Oxford Street, New Oxford Street and Charing Cross Road. It's called St. Giles Circus. You can't cross the road without threat to your life, and I think you should go there. So the idea of being a frontline reporter, it's like 10 minutes away from my house, you know, dodging buses and bikes and, you know, getting some sentences out of it. Well, that's my idea of fun, I suppose.
Well, you talk about frontline there, so in fact that takes us, that segues very neatly to the Illuminations, because of course we've got two parallel stories that tie together in the Illuminations. We've got Anne, an older woman who is suffering from dementia, who's had a life and a career as a photographer, but all sort of hidden now in the midst of time. And we have her grandson, Luke, who is on the front line in Afghanistan. And it's one thing to say that it was dangerous to cross the road in Tottenham Court Road, but you did actually go to Afghanistan to research the Illuminations. Where did you go? How did you go? How was it? Because you've given us such a visceral, physical, raw experience of it on the page. It's very powerful.
I had always been very struck when I was younger by a comment of Martha Gellhorn's, the great war reporter, when she said that if you're going to write about war or conflict, you have to taste it. And she didn't just mean the weather and the food and the customs, she meant the fear. And there is a particular frightening aspect to rolling down the road in a place like Afghanistan in the midst of a war when there are roadside bombs going off right, left and centre. I mean, one day in Kabul, when we were travelling in convoy, there had been four bomb incidents involving vehicles that day. And so beginning to understand how these 19, 20-year-old soldiers must feel in convoy as they cross that war-torn land became a very important thing for me for the book, because I knew that there would be sentences and paragraphs set in that very world, 50-degree heat, young, inexperienced, ambitious men in close proximity. How would it affect their verbals, their sense of the future, their sense of who they were and who the enemy was? Mm. And that only comes from being there. So I had some difficulty getting into Afghanistan, I have to tell you.
Did you go in with UNICEF? Because I saw you wearing a UNICEF t-shirt in a photograph.
I had to go in with UNICEF because the Ministry of Defence, in their wisdom, wouldn't let me in. They thought I was untrustworthy on the politics. It's interesting, we've got to a point in history where the Public Relations Department of the Ministry of Defence makes a kind of adjudication about your political rightness to witness things or not. But anyway, they decided against. So I went in with UNICEF, with whom I've had a 20-year relationship. I've been an ambassador for UNICEF. So they'd been asking me to go to the field for quite some time anyway. So I went in a different way. It meant I spent more time with children and did some of the charity work that I would be expected to do there, and I was very honoured to do. Spent time with child jihadis quite a lot. So I got a lot of the background for the villagers in the book from talking to those families. But then I would go off piste and find soldiers and begin to get a sense of what their experience was. Some of them I saw back in Belfast. When I got back, you know, well, they lived their normal lives, to put it that way. One of these guys had been, a guy called Andy, had been blown up in Helmand province. He'd lost both his legs and the sight in one eye. This guy had two children. He was 21. And he was just an absolute, you know, font of decency, tolerance, wisdom and information about the war. And I became very close to him for a period when I was preparing the novel.
You talked there about the taste of fear, which reminded me of something that Kate Adey told me once, which was that she said, you know, nobody ever says that everybody at the front line's wearing nappies, because you do shit yourself from fear. And that is one of those details which, when you hear it, it, you know, it sticks in your mind, but you've never been told that before.
Well, it is frightening, and, you know, no matter how well trained you are, and these young serving men and women are trained to the nth degree. They're brilliant at their jobs. Yet you can't train people out of fear, and you wouldn't want to, because fear is a great motivator in a combat situation. And so what you see is long afternoons suddenly becoming riotous with danger and threat. And they respond to it brilliantly, but the danger is deep-seated, because how can you legislate against roadside bombs? You're just rolling along the road, and next minute the whole vehicle's sky high, and that's a big fear.
What's the impact of all of that, of seeing all of that, of experiencing all of that, then on you, Andrew, when you come back? We have a well-known painter called Ben Quilty, who went to paint soldiers who were serving in Afghanistan in combat, and who painted paintings that are very full of the anguish of PTSD. And he himself came back with some of that trauma, having witnessed what he'd witnessed. What about you?
Well, of course, what interests me as a writer isn't centrally the war, and this isn't a war novel in the old-fashioned sense where it's all about bullets flying in the combat zone. It's actually a book about the home front. And Luke Campbell, who's the young officer at the who serves in Afghanistan, he's on his way home, really. And it's what happens to him in his relationship with his grandmother, Anne Quirk, who's been suffering from dementia. And she has been a great leading light to him in his life, and something of a self-inventor in her own life. And her life's coming back to haunt her in a way now. And so he comes out of this war situation into a situation which is affected by war, affected by other sorts of delusions as well, because the war is a delusion to him by this stage. And post-trauma is something that he's experiencing at some deep level, and the unfolding of that becomes the story of the book.
Mm.
You know, but I've always been interested in the long journey home. I mean, it's as old as tea. I mean, it's the oldest story in literature. It's the story of the Odyssey. It's the warrior comes home, and the long journey back to being the human being you were before all this blood, before all this tragedy.
When you come home, things are not the same at home, are they? People are
affected, of course, there as well. I mean, war doesn't just change the environment in which the war takes place. It changes the environment of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And back in the west coast of Scotland, where most of the book takes place, it's been changed by this war. 25 years of almost continual conflict and interventions around the world have changed my generation,
mm-hmm.
and the generations above and below us. You know, they don't know what it's like to not have the idea of British intervention in the world on the nightly news. You know, 25 years of continual conflict in the Balkans, in Northern Ireland, in Kosovo, in Sierra Leone, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, just continually. I mean, the Second World War only lasted 6 years.
Mm.
So my generation has had a particularly relentless experience of threat and the dangers of international conflict.
Yes, that's true. I hadn't thought of it that way. Now, Anne, in the meantime, her past is sort of coming back to meet her, and her younger self is sort of coming to meet her. And that makes your depiction of dementia, in a way, much less fearful and dark than many other people's. But it made me wonder what you personally fear about getting old. I mean, have you thought about that for yourself?
You know, it's an interesting question, that, because, you know, novelists live in a kind of miasma of portent. You know, how will things become? You have to, in order to write novels, you need to conjure all the time with what will things become. You know, you give your characters hinterlands and pasts, but you also give them portents of the future. How are they likely to change? How are they likely to survive or not? So I think we're especially sort of, you know, inured to this experience of what time does to a person. And in my case, it's changed. You know, when I was younger, I'm in my late 40s now, I've been writing since my early 20s. And in my 20s, I couldn't even contemplate the future or, you know, annihilation or, you know, illness or any of those things. Like most people, I couldn't, there wasn't a space in my head for it. Now there's a great space in my head for it. But you know what? The surprising thing is I'm quite comfortable with it. You know, you get over, you cross the Rubicon almost in your own consciousness, and you don't embrace the idea of death, but you certainly embrace the idea of your lack of invincibility.
Okay.
Because you watch people die. You lose a parent. You might lose a friend.
Mm-hmm.
And it absolutely alters your sense of your, not only your own invincibility, but of the sort of the temporary nature of things arrives in your lap. You now know that we're all on borrowed time. And that adds a certain kind of fervour, I think, to your depictions of life.
Mm.
And even a kind of savour to your notion of what it is to be alive. I would say that my sense of life now is more finely grained than it was when I wrote The Missing. I wrote The Missing when I was 24.
Mm.
A whole book about missing children and people losing their lives and losing their existence and their identity. And I hardly batted an eyelid through the whole research. I couldn't write that book now. I've got a child. I could never write The Missing now.
That's interesting. Because that is still, I have to say, probably one of my most favourite of your books. I think it's an absolutely extraordinary book. But thinking about that, and then thinking about the fact that I gather that you recently took a name from a gravestone for a play that you're writing, it struck me that all of your work, the body of your work, is really an investigation and exploration of identity.
Always. Yeah, from the beginning. I've been interested in what you might call the instability of selfhood.
Mm-hmm. Whether that's a celebrity,
yeah,
or a soldier.
Yeah, all the time. I mean, I've found different permutations and also different realizations of it. You know, a young celebrity and the threat to self represented by fame is one way of looking at the mirrors surrounding a person and how it distorts and affects and can annihilate them, as it did in the case of the character who Maria Tambini in Personality was based on, Lena Zavaroni, a person,
yes,
who died very young from, as it were, the threat to her basic selfness, her basic existence. I've always been interested in that sort of fraying of identity. It seems to me especially an aspect of how we live now.
Very much so, and never more so than when we're looking at flawed celebrities. You know, you talk about frayed personality as well. Your essay on Jimmy Savile was, you know, one of the most gripping sort of deconstructions of that particularly sinister phenomenon. And this is a story that doesn't go away. There's more coming out all the time. And you're here in Australia at the same time as we're watching Cardinal Pell give evidence in the case of people who were abused by priests in the Catholic Church. Do you keep thinking about the Jimmy Savile story all the time as the news keeps throwing up more monsters?
Yes, I mean, keep thinking is indeed the condition, I think, with this. I mean, are now having to accept, those of us who are of a certain age, that our childhoods now look very different to us. The cultural world of our childhood, all those TV presenters, those DJs, those priests who took us through our sacraments, they all look very different to us now, because they represent a culture of abuse. They represent a culture of secret abuse. And we now know that the world is not what it seemed. You know, the TV programs that we loved, It's a Knockout, Jim Will Fix It, were actually presented by what can only now be described as known abusers of children. And that alters your whole landscape and your understanding of what decency is. When I was writing about the culture of the BBC, I just happened to discover sources who would lead me into what we can only describe as these fearful corridors of undescribed social history, where a culture of abuse existed, much as it existed in the Catholic Church all over the world, and we're now seeing it, we're hearing more of it, even this week, even today. I think it's an unending story for us, because it questions the very basis of our society about protection, about looking after children, about knowing what authority is and what authority represents. Mm. It turns out that we didn't take care of our children or ourselves in the way that we might have. And so, yes, essays about that should go all the way into your fears and all the way into your culture, because this is not going away. Neither should it go away. We've probably seen a small fraction. We're probably aware of a small fraction of what actually happened now. But it has to come out. No cleansing can begin. I mean, the Catholic Church would like it all to go away, obviously, but it's not going away. And they did too much making it go away in the past, in fact. So they don't have a leg to stand on with this. They need to absolutely cleanse and speak and open every single avenue of inquiry, instead of covering it up, sending priests off into safe zones. Won't do, I'm afraid.
No. So I have to ask you, since you have written quite a lot about celebrity in fiction and in these essays, is there a celebrity who particularly fascinates or intrigues you at the moment that you would love to get close to?
I spent some time recently with Karl Lagerfeld, and I thought he was completely fascinating in a kind of Warholian sense. Mm-hmm. I mean, he wasn't quite a flesh and blood reality to me. I spent a bit of time with him both in Paris and in South Korea. I went around with him. It was quite extraordinary because, you know, we had a lot to say to each other. He's a very bright man, a bit of a philosopher of style, really. And in that sense, an old-fashioned character. It was like being with a cross between Descartes and Coco Chanel. You know, it was great fun. But ultimately, like so many celebrities that have interested me, he was hardly there.
Mm. I mean, he sort of wafts a bit, doesn't he?
Yeah, I mean, he's ghostly.
Yes.
There's a level of fame that can exist now where the person is almost sort of bleached out of existence with the level of renown and fame. But it takes all human stuff and sort of bleaches out the way.
So you end up with a negative of the photograph.
It's a negative, yeah. I mean, there are no lines on such a person. But internally, there's a struggle that they are constantly engaged with to maintain selfhood at the centre of this great sort of circus, you know, of grotesques. And he wasn't grotesque, Karl Lagerfeld, but, I mean, since you asked me for one that strikes me, he does strike me.
Does that make him an ideal character for you in terms of fiction? Do you sort of hang around with someone like that and think, I can use that, and I can use that, and I'm going to create a fashion designer at some stage later down the track?
I wish the toolbox was this sort of, you know, systematic and effective as that. It's not, though. I mean, you absorb these people the way you absorb every encounter that you have, and you hope that at some level it sort of informs or enlarges, in some way magnifies your sense of what human beings are. Because as a storyteller, you're always coming back to that, and you look again and again at the possible material. But it's never as systematic as, oh, there's Carl's way of looking and picking up a glass is going straight into this novel. You're in a trance when you're writing a novel, and sometimes it will just come up.
Mm.
And it might even change the course of the book, a detail, a human trait, but you don't know it's going to until it does.
It's been wonderful talking to you. Thank you so much, Andrew.
Such a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. And don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.